I'll readily admit that I'm not an expert at technology, but I do know a few simple tricks. And one of those tricks is that if you have something that's technology driven and it's not working, the first step is to turn it off and reboot it. If you have a phone that's stuck in an app, you can't get it off the app, force close it down and reboot it. If your computer is glitched up, if it's lagging and slow, you shut it down and reboot it. If your internet quit working, you unplug it and then you reboot it. For some reason, and maybe some of y'all that are more technology driven, you could let me know, simply shutting something down and rebooting a technology can make it go faster, can get rid of complications, can go over obstacles. It can be a great thing for your devices. And unfortunately, we can't reboot our lives as much as we want to. You know, some people say that a nap is pretty close to rebooting, but in reality, we can't reboot ourselves as much as we want. But we do need a time, some seems like, of renewal, rejuvenation, of a reboot. And we're especially sensitive to that in January when the new year comes around, and also being a time where the new president's going to be placed in office soon. Now we're thinking about that. How about renewal and the need to be rebooted? And then the question becomes then, how do we do that? What does it look like? What do we need to happen for us to receive that reboot like we are looking for and like we need? That's where the book of Nehemiah can help. Nehemiah looks at the people of Israel several hundred years ago, and back then Israel needed a reboot too in their lives. In 586, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came in and he destroyed the city of Jerusalem. He destroyed God's temple there in Jerusalem. And he took most of the Jews that were there out of Israel and sent them to another country to live in other countries outside of Israel. And then a few decades later, in 539, a guy named Cyrus the Great of Persia issued a decree allowing Israelites to move back from a foreign country to Israel, where they want to live. And the Israelites were excited. It was a reboot. It was a chance to restart their nation like they wanted to do. And so that's what they did. And excitement was good. And they had some obstacles. But eventually they did manage to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem in 516 BC. But after that, things did not turn out like they were hoping. And it was not this glorious reboot that they had envisioned when they first came. A lot of people that were foreigners were living in their cities, in their houses, on their land, and they were causing problems and obstacles and trouble for the Israelites that came back. Israel was still a vassal country that was underneath empires like Persia. And the kings of Persia sometimes didn't let them do things they needed to do. And then there was a ton of Israelites who just didn't care. They were apathetic. They wanted to stay in Persia. They didn't want to come back to Israel like God told them to. And those who were faithful to come back to Israel found out that after that long journey, that life in Israel was way more difficult than they expected it was going to be after rebooting their life. And so by the time Nehemiah comes around, it has been about 70 years since the temple in Jerusalem had been rebuilt. And the country has gotten nowhere. They were comfortable. They got comfortable where they were at. They got comfortable with their progress they made. And they basically stalled and quit pushing forward. And because of that, the country was still in a mess. It's a lot like, you could say, like a house. If you take a house and you don't take care of it, if you don't clean up and climb up a ladder and clean out the gutters and that kind of stuff, eventually a house falls apart. Or it's like our bodies. If you... It's a whole lot easier to watch Netflix and sit around than it is to run a 5K. But if all you do is sit around and don't maintain a house, or all you do is sit around and watch Netflix and don't maintain your body, eventually your body or your house is going to decay, it's going to fall apart, it's going to ruin. And our spiritual lives as individuals and as a church are no different. We can be like the Israelites. We can have progress individually and as a church, and we can be pushing forward, and then we can get comfortable with how far we've gotten, and we can stop. But just like the Israelites, if you quit moving forward, then you'll start to move backwards unconsciously. And if you quit maintaining your spiritual life, if you quit maintaining the spiritual life of the church, then naturally the church in your life is going to decay. It's going to grow spiritually fat. It's going to go into ruin. And so what we need sometimes is to go to our great physician, the Lord, and ask him to give us a checkup and say, how are we doing spiritually? And do we need a reboot? And again, that's where Nehemiah is coming into place. Ezra chapter 10 is connected to Nehemiah. The book of Nehemiah and Ezra are connected together. But Ezra chapter 10 does not end well. And so about 13 years later, you get Nehemiah chapter 1. And when you get to the verses we have today, chapter 1, verses 1 through 4, the question that comes up is, what is the first step that you need to do if you want to reboot your family, your life, your country, your church, your community? What is the very first step to having a reboot? That's what we find out in these first four short verses. So let's first read about what happens to this man named Nehemiah. Let's read verses 1 and 2. It says, the words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah. Now it happened in the months of Kislev, in the 20th year, while I was in Susa, the capital, that Hanani, one of my brothers, and some men from Judah came, and I asked them about the Jews who had escaped and had survived the captivity and about Jerusalem. So we learn about this godly man named Nehemiah. And the name Nehemiah means God comforts. And certainly God is going to use Nehemiah in these chapters to comfort Israel. We also are given a very specific date for when this book begins, which is pretty neat. Kislev in the 20th month of King Artaxerxes. So that we can date that to the end of November in 445 BC. So that's about 70 years after the Temple of Jerusalem has indeed been rebuilt. And we found out a location. It's in Susa. Susa was the capital city of the Persian Empire. And it was a grand city. It was a big city, which makes sense that Nehemiah is there. Because later in chapter 1, we'll find out that he's a cupbearer. Which is actually one of the most lucrative and prestigious jobs a person could have. So Nehemiah has clout, he has money, no doubt in his house in Susa, it's lavish, it's big, he's got a good thing going for him socially, good thing going for him financially, and he's sitting in this grand city of Susa when he hears a at his door. He gets up, he opens it, and he sees that it's Hanani, his brother, along with some of Hanani's friends. And they probably hadn't seen each other in a while. And you can imagine if you hadn't seen your brother or your sister for a while, how would you react to that? I know for me, it would be like, hey, I'll be smiling, I'll grab them, I would hug them, I'd be so happy. Hanani lives over 1,000 miles away from Susa in Jerusalem, which is the distance from here to Boston, Massachusetts, by the way. They're about the same distance. And they don't have planes, so you can imagine that they don't see each other very often. So Nehemiah, no doubt, and Hanani, they're excited, they embrace each other. He invites them into his great, lavish home there in Susa, and they begin to talk a little bit about and just chat along with the friends there in his living room. But Nehemiah is a man after God's heart. And even though he has this great job in Susa with King Artaxerxes, his heart is for God's people. And even though he's sitting in Susa, he longs to see the city of Jerusalem. And so eventually he gets around to a burning question that has been on his heart and a burden on his heart for a long time. He says, Hanani, how are the people there in Jerusalem? And how is the city itself? You see, by asking this question, he's trying to gauge not just the physical capability, but the spiritual capability. Jerusalem is the city that was supposed to be rebuilt when God's people came back. It was the city where the Messiah was supposed to come, where the Messiah was supposed to walk, and one day teach, and then die, and be crucified. And so the spiritual condition of the people is linked to the physical condition of the city of Jerusalem. And so he's got this desire to know, what are God's people like? And so we see in these first two passages a godly man who asks about the condition of God's people. He's worried about them. He wants to know something about them. He exposes himself to learn more about what God's people and God's mission is like around the world. So with that question, the attitude in the room completely changes in chapter 3. In verse 3, sorry. And if you go ahead and put that on the screen for verse 3, you'll see that Hananiah is also a man that has a burden or gets burdened by the condition of God's people. Let's read verse 3. It says, "And they said to me, the remnant there in the providence here survived the captivity or in great distress and disgrace. And the wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates have been burned with fire." So they've been talking. I imagine, this is Michael, I imagine they've been talking and laughing, cutting up, like family or friends do that haven't seen each other in a while. But with that question, like I said, the atmosphere changes. It gets thick as you can cut a knife in that room. All the Hananiah and all the other Jews, their faces drop. And they look at their eyes look at the floor. And they say, "Nehemiah, it ain't good, man. God's people are broken. God's people are broken emotionally. They're in trouble. They're in disgrace. They're in shame. They're in reproach. And God's people, they're broken physically. The city of Jerusalem is not in good shape. And the walls are still torn down." Now this, we learn, disturbs Nehemiah. You see, the walls were originally torn down by Nebuchadnezzar in 586. But Ezra chapter 4 tells us that the first group of Jews that came back began to rebuild it. But King Artaxerxes, the same king Nehemiah works for, that king, sent a letter and halted the wall from being built. And more likely, after that wall got finished being built, people came in from outside that were opponents of Israel and hated Israel, and they probably tore it down even further, either out of spite or just to use the materials for their own houses and stuff. And so Nehemiah learns about these walls that he thought were going to be rebuilt, that he expected were going to be in good condition, that God's word had promised were going to be great, and they're not there. And he realizes that the people in Israel are still broken spiritually. That the reboot wasn't really there. And that the spiritual progress that they had made from 586 through 516 had stalled. And instead of continuing to move forward, they stopped moving forward. And so they started moving backwards. And that was proven by the fact that the walls still were not there. And he was broken by the condition of those people. Now, he probably knew it was bad. I mean, Susa was the capital. He had probably heard some things. But there's a difference between hearing something and looking a brother in the eye and seeing their tears as they tell you the news about it. So something about that moment, when he heard it face to face with somebody that seen it, it broke his heart. Here he was, sitting on a lush couch in a great city with a prestigious job in a luxurious area of town. He had all the capabilities. He had all the means to make a difference in God's people, and that he was there while God's people were suffering physically and emotionally. And the thought, not just that they were suffering physically and emotionally, but that Nehemiah could help and he was not doing everything he could, put the burden even worse on his shoulders. And so we see his reaction to this news in verse 4. That he prays and weeps for the condition of God's people. It says in verse 4, "Now when I heard these words, I sat down and I wept and mourned for days, and I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven." The weight of that news hit him like an anvil. For some reason on that day, God placed a holy burden on his shoulders. And while he had been standing this whole time, all he could do now was sit. And hot tears began to stream down his eyes about this. And all he could think to do was weep for the brokenness of God's people and to pray. But he didn't just pray that one time and get up and do something, but we find out inside chapter 2 that he makes a plan. And he begins to fast also. He begins to take periods of time and change his habits so you can systematically pray and meditate and about what God can do for God's people. And he did it for 4 months, according to chapter 2, verse 1. For 4 months. Why was he doing that? Because Nehemiah knows two things. One, that he serves the God of heaven. That's in verse 4. The God of heaven. He serves a God who is sovereign, who's in control, that God can move the king's heart, that God can move individual hearts, he can move a country's heart. He believes that he serves the God of heaven, and so he needs to beseech the God of heaven about this. But not just his praying and fasting so that God will move, he's praying and fasting so that God will show him what to do. He knows he needs to do something as an individual, but he doesn't know what that thing is. And instead of just going about his life, he fasts for 4 months and beseeches God, God, how do you want me to relieve the burden of God's people and the brokenness they're feeling? Because I know I have the means and ability to do it. Just show me the details and what that is. For 4 months. So we see that Nehemiah, he's not just a man who feels burdened, a holy man that feels burdened by, a good man that feels burdened by God's people. We see he's a man who gets a burden, and it leads him to do something. It pushes him to go and make action on it. And the first step of that action is to pray. He just simply prays. So what we see in this story is a godly man who develops a deep burden for God's people that drives him to have a holy ambition to do something, the first of which is pray. And these four verses, the burden he has in that moment will be the straw that breaks the camel's back that will drive him for the rest of 13 chapters in this book. And the reality is, if you want a renewal, if you want a revival, if you want a reboot, you have to have a Nehemiah moment in your life too. You have to be burdened by the condition of God's people. Are you burdened by the condition of God's people? You know, when was the last time that you came and you prayed to God about something that was going on spiritually? When was the last time that you wept over the spiritual progress of the church? When was the last time that you had a deep sense that I have to do something when you saw the lostness and the brokenness in the community around you? Do you have a burden for the condition of God's people? I don't think we have that burden like we should. Because the actions we do not show it. The actions we do not... Oh, we'll talk about it. We're good about talking about it. We'll talk about the lost in the world. We're talking about churches that are struggling. We'll talk about our friends that are not Christians or have fallen away. We'll talk about our family that aren't believers. We'll talk about Christians that are suffering and persecuted. We will talk about it, but what do we do about it? We will talk about it, but we're not burdened by it. When's the last time you've given sacrificially for world missions? When's the last time that you wept for God's people? When's the last time you fasted for the progress of the gospel? We will talk about it, but we are not burdened by it. In 1968, there is a runner from Tanzania. Let me make sure I get his name right here. His name was John Aquaria. And he traveled from Tanzania to Mexico City to run in a marathon. Now, he was not familiar with the altitude and climatic conditions of Mexico City. And so while Aquaria was running, he got a cramp in his leg. And listen to this. His cramp was so bad, it dislocated his knee. I had never heard that before, but that's what happened to this guy. But he kept running with a dislocated knee, and he finished the race. Granted, he was an hour slower than the guy who won, which is probably still faster than I would have ran it, to be honest. But he still finished. When he finished, people came up to him. They said, "John, why did you keep running with a dislocated knee? Didn't it hurt?" He's like, "Yes, it hurt. But my country didn't send me 5,000 miles to run in a race. My country sent me 5,000 miles to finish a race." His country put a burden on his shoulders, and that drove him to finish the race well. If you don't have a gospel burden on your shoulders, if our church doesn't get a gospel burden on our shoulders, then we will not finish our race well. So how do you develop a burden for the condition of God's people? Well, let's do what Nehemiah did. There's two steps here. The first step is you have to expose yourself to the condition of God's people. You have to expose yourself to it. That's what Nehemiah did. He was interested in it, and he went and he simply asked, how are God's people doing? How is God's kingdom doing? He exposed himself to that information. And that's the first step you have to take too. Because see, the thing is, you're going to be burdened by the things you expose yourself to. And the more you expose yourself to it, the more you're going to be burdened by it. And one of the reasons we're not burdened for the condition of God's people is because we don't expose ourselves to the condition of God's people. Let me show you. How many of you guys know who's going to be in the NCAA football championship coming up? Who is it? Ohio State, Notre Dame. Anybody want Ohio State to win? Okay, I know we had one person that was high. Anybody want Notre Dame to win?
I don't care.
Anybody wish they both could lose somehow? Yes. Anyway, that's how I am. I'm like, I wish both of them could lose. Put L's on both of them. That's how I feel. Any of you guys follow the royal family, Prince William? What's his wife's name? Anybody know who Prince William's wife's name is?
Kate.
Kate? A bunch of y'all know that. What's their kids' names?
Charles.
Charles?
Charlotte.
Charlotte's George, Charlotte, and Louis. Oh, yeah. So y'all know, at least y'all know the wife. Y'all know the kids as well. Any of you guys follow TikTok? Any younger ones follow TikTok and that? You looked to see any of the trends, tried out any trends recently? I think Jake Ladd, looking at his face, looks like he's done some trends. Let me ask you this question. How many Christians were martyred in 2024 for being a Christian? 4,476 were martyred around the world for being a Christian. How many people in the country of England, Kate Middleton's country, how many people in that country, if they were to die today, would go to hell and not heaven because they're currently unbelievers? What percentage? 70? 94% of the people in England are currently on the way to hell. Okay, that's internationally. Let's bring it down locally here. In our St. Clair County Baptist Association, not just in our whole county, not just every church, just in the Baptist Association of St. Clair County, how many churches do not have pastors right now?
Six.
Nine. And thankfully, we're not as bad as England, but how many people in St. Clair County, if they were to die today, would go to hell because they're lost? What percentage? 55%, more than half. More than half of the people you meet at the grocery store, at your schools, in your workplace, more than half of them are currently on the way to hell. Oh, we'll talk about how we want the church to grow. We'll talk about how we want baptisms. We'll talk about how good it is to share the gospel. We'll talk about how we want more disciples to be made. We'll talk about it, but we're not burdened by it because we don't expose ourselves to it. We don't know. We don't ask. So we have no burden. And so, how do we fix that? You have to put yourself in places to be exposed to that kind of information. And to give you help, Wednesday nights are one of the great places to do that. Wednesday nights, we spend some time every Wednesday, and we talk about the global world and what's going on with salvations and our nation. And so one of the ways to be exposed is just to weekly make a part of your schedule, either in person or online. I've got a Zoom link I'm going to start posting on Facebook, to be exposed to those conversations. I came in here and I brought some boxes in here. In here is stuff that's like a calendar that you can grab. There's some little booklets and things that tell you about the lostness in our state. There's some that talk about the lostness in our country. There's some that talk about where our churches are. Grab some of those if you wish at the end of the service and use that. We use those on Wednesday night. The IMB has an app that you can go to. You can download the app on your phone, or you can apply for an email newsletter. And every week or every month, they will send you prayer requests to tell you what's going on around the world. It's not that there's no way for you to know. It's that we don't access those people that know and have those opportunities for us. Put yourself in places where you can be exposed. We do not do this stuff on Wednesday night for fun. We do it because we're developing a burden for the condition of God's people around the world. That's the first step you have to do. The second step is you need to pray. Pray for the condition of God's people. That's what Nehemiah did. He came, and when he got that burden, he didn't just leave it in his heart, but the burden came out of his heart, out of his mouth, as a worshipful prayer to God. And we got to come to a moment where we put ourselves in places where we are praying for the spiritual conditions of God's people. And again, we will pray. We certainly will pray for stuff. But what do our prayers sound like? Our prayers sound more like a list of people who are in the hospital and have health needs. You know, we have all these people that are going through conditions, and we have almost little time saved for people who have some sort of spiritual need. We don't hardly pray for the lost that are going on. We don't hardly mention people who are unchurched by name. And what does that say about us? What do that kinds of prayers say about us? It says we care more about the physical conditions of people than the eternal destinations of people. It means we care more about what doctors can do for somebody's bodies than what Jesus can do for somebody's soul. Mm-hmm. And so we need to pray, and we need to pray frequently, and we don't need to make prayer for somebody's spiritual condition a last-minute ditch effort when something goes bad, but something that we do all the time. Lord of the Rings has a very interesting character in it. I'm a Lord of the Rings fan. And the character is the eagles. Now, the eagles in Lord of the Rings are not these tiny little birds. They're big. They're way bigger than real birds are. And in Lord of the Rings, the main character Frodo is given the task of taking a magical ring, trekking all the way across the country, and throwing it into a volcano called Mount Doom to destroy the ring. And so that's basically the synopsis of all three books of Lord of the Rings, by the way. I just told you what happened. At the very end of Lord of the Rings, Frodo succeeds in throwing the ring into Mount Doom, but he's mortally wounded. And he's laying on the side of Mount Doom, and he's dying. And it doesn't look like he's going to survive. And at that moment, out of the sky, these eagles fly in. And they pick him up and save him. And they carry him back to safety. Now, one of the dying questions that non-Lord of the Rings fans often ask is, if the eagles could pick up Frodo at the end of the story, why couldn't they have just done that at the beginning of the story? Like, why did they make Frodo trek through the entire country, mostly by himself? Why did they go through all that pain? Why did they go through all that trouble if the eagles could have just picked him up, carried him to Mount Doom, and dropped him? Because that's what happened at the end. They picked him up and carried him back to safety. And Lord of the Rings fans have answers to that. But my point is this. Often we treat our prayer for the spiritual conditions of people like it's the eagle coming in to save the day at the last moment just when somebody is in trouble. You know, we won't pray that much for the spiritual condition of a friend until they're in a car wreck and they're about to die. We're like, oh my God, please God, help them be saved. Or we don't think that much about our children and praying for our children's spiritual condition until somebody grows up and they leave the church and they walk away from God. Or we don't pray about the churches that are in our community until one is about to close the doors. We will pray for people's spiritual condition, but it is an emergency lever we pull at the last minute just when the situation is dire. And that's not how it should be. It should be something that is part of your weekly and daily routine. And again, that is a part of what we try to help you do on Wednesday nights. You can take these resources I have up here, make it a part of your weekly and daily routine at home. But make it a part of what you do when you wake up, praying for your kids, for your family, for your coworkers and stuff too. Try to think up plans like, what am I going to do? When's the last time you fasted for your friends at school? When's the last time you fasted for your coworkers at school that are lost? Maybe that needs to be something Nehemiah did that you need to do. When's the last time you wept because you have a family member who used to go to church and doesn't go to church anymore? When's the last time you mourned over somebody like that? Maybe that needs to be something you say, I need to spend 4 months doing is focused on prayer for them. We need to quit talking about it. We need to be burdened by it. We need to let the burden lead us to do something about it. And the first step that you can do is the easiest step you can do, which is pray. And so, you have here in this story a man who's a godly man. And when he hears about the conditions of God's people, he receives a burden for it so much that he feels like he has to do something. And the first thing he does is he gets up and pray. And the same thing must be true for you. If you want a reboot and a renewal, you must be burdened by the condition of God's people, by exposing yourself to that condition and then praying for that condition. And so what I'm going to do, I'm going to have to ask Jamie to come forward in the next few moments, where I'm actually going to ask you to, we're going to close this service a little bit different. You can come up, Jamie, a little differently from what we normally do. Tom can come forward too if you want. But Jamie's going to play the invitation song, but Tom's not going to sing. Because instead of us standing up and singing and going home again, what I want us to do is actually do what God's Word tells us to do, and that's pray. If you're here today and you are not a believer in Christ, you say, you know what? I don't understand what all this burden is for. Why are you so insistent on that? And I'd love to talk to you about why Jesus Christ and His death on the cross is so important. But if you're here today and you are a believer in Jesus, what I want us to do today is I want to flood this area up here with people praying for the spiritual condition and progress of God's kingdom. Now, I know that normally people come up here, we think of this up here as being the place that, you know, individuals go who have crushing decisions they have to make and that kind of stuff. But for today, I'm asking you, if you're physically able, to come up while Jamie simply plays music and pray. Pray for missionaries around the world. Pray for the 9 churches that don't have pastors. Pray for the people that you know that are lost. Pray for your children and grandchildren that aren't going to church. Let that burden I know you have on your heart express itself in prayer here before God. And let's show our community that Greensport Church is a church that has a burden for God's people that does something about it. Mm-hmm. And that this altar is not just for individuals who feel broken, but it is for a church that wants to give their burdens to the Lord because they know He's the God of heaven. Mm-hmm. So after I pray, I ask that you respond as God leads in your heart.